say yes to a new love affair. Then I'll close my eyes to everything that's gay. If you are not there, ah, to share each lovely day. And through the years, and those moments when we're far apart, don't you know I'll close my eyes?
And you don't hear none of those stations playing them. Ask why. In fact, where are those stations today? Somebody better ask somebody that. The people that's most affected by this war.
From animal rights and the anti-war movement to civil disobedience and culture jamming, Justice or Just Us examines law, equality, public policy, and social activism. Tune in Thursdays 8 to 9 a.m. on KUCI in Irvine and KUCI.org.
Darling, you say you want to write a book? Well, then you must listen to Writers on Writing, darling. Authors, literary agents gabbing and babbling about the art and the business of writing. Thursdays, 5 p.m. Darling, you must. Barbara DeMarco Barrett, she hosts. Yeah, listen, darling.
On KUCI FM in Irvine.
Weekly Signals, every Tuesday morning from 8 to 9 a.m. Join me, Mike Casper, and Nathan Callahan for the best in reality-based radio. That's Weekly Signals. Check out the website at weeklysignals.com.
The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. To find out more about this talk show or other talk shows broadcasting on KUCI, log on to our website at kuci.org or check out the latest program guide.
And good evening and welcome to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org and we're available via podcast, either through iTunes or at Barbara DeMarco Barrett's website, penonfire.com. Simply click on the radio tower at the top left side of your screen, which will lead you to our radio page. And near the top of that page is a link to archives of the past shows. This interview will join lots and lots of others up and available to you now. And if you don't have the opportunity to listen to our show live, this is a great way to ensure you don't miss out. I'm your host, Marie Stone, in for Barbara, who will be back with you next week. Writers on Writing features conversations with authors, poets, agents, publishers, anyone and everyone having to do with the art and business of writing. And tonight I'm joined by two wonderful up-and-coming authors. Tara Eisen is with me now, and coming up in our second half hour, please stay with me because Erin Kyle will be here. Tara Eisen's first novel, A Child Out of Alcatraz, was a finalist for the 1997 Los Angeles Times Book Award Best First Fiction. Her short fiction, essays, and book reviews have appeared or are forthcoming in Tin House, The Kenyon Review, The Mississippi Review, The LA Times Sunday Magazine and Book Review, as well as numerous other journals, newspapers, and anthologies. She's also the co-writer of the movie Don't Tell Mom the Babysitter's Dead. But it's her new novel, The List, published by Scribner and released in March of this year, that will be the focus of our discussion this evening. Tara, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Can you hear us okay?
Yeah, I can hear you fine.
Perfect, perfect. You know, I can't say that The List was an entirely fun read, but but it was so...
Sorry about that.
No, no, it was so well done. It was, for those who haven't read it yet, it was a little like The War of the Roses before they got married.
Yeah, yeah, a little bit.
In their courtship years. And I know relationships like this, you know, sometimes a little too well. I've known relationships like this, and there were so many things, so much psychology that you got so right.
Oh, thank you.
It was really, really great. Before I delve too deeply into the book itself, I want to talk first a little bit about the path that led you here. Can you talk a little first about kind of your road into writing and how you got started and what pulled you in?
Sure. I think when I was growing up, I always wanted to be a writer. I always loved the image of writers, especially in movies, you know, in the beach house and the Parisian garret and, you know, romantic love affairs and all that kind of thing. And I didn't really realize that you have to actually write in order to be a writer. And I took some writing classes in college and was absolutely terrified by the experience of it. But then my last year as an undergrad at UCLA, a friend and I got together and we started writing screenplays together. And 2 months after I graduated from UCLA, we sold our first screenplay to Fox.
Wow.
So suddenly I was a screenwriter. And, you know, that was a blast. The money was great, and it was a lot of fun. And it was a kind of writing that maybe felt, I don't know, a little safer, maybe a little less personal for me.
Mm-hmm.
And so I did that for 6 or 7 years, and I actually learned a lot. I learned a lot about story and character and structure, and I'm profoundly grateful for that training and that experience. But at some point I had an idea for a story that I just fell so madly in love with, about a family living on Alcatraz, a mother-daughter story. And I assumed I'd write it as a screenplay, and I researched it for 4 years. And as I started working on it, I realized that if it were a screenplay, there would be no way it wouldn't turn into convict escape, hold the little girl hostage kind of story.
Right.
And that really wasn't the story I wanted to tell. So I decided to take the plunge and try writing it as a novel.
Mm.
And it really was my first fiction, and I don't know by what miracle I actually managed to write it, but I did. And then even more miraculously, it was published, and that's it. I sort of went forward as a fiction writer from that point.
So it sounds kind of easy, you know? It sounds like you wrote this book and you got it published, and I
yeah, it sounds great, doesn't it? I think I did get lucky as a screenwriter. I think I did sort of stumble into it a little bit. And maybe I've been lucky as a fiction writer also, and if so, I'm really grateful for that luck. But I mean, I am one of those writers that hates writing. I would rather do anything than write. I would rather clean my bathroom or take the dog for a walk or clean my refrigerator than write. But it really is that love-hate kind of thing, because as soon as I actually sort of get myself in a chair and start doing it, I go to this other place. I enter the zone, and it's an incredibly fulfilling experience. I just don't know how I do it. I mean, I wake up in the morning and there are pages that I've written, and I always joke that I feel like some elf came in the middle of the night while I was sleeping and got the work done, because I sort of zone out.
Boy, I wish that would happen to me.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I read something somewhere that I thought was so wonderful, that you said someplace that you don't write every day.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's so refreshing to hear, because usually the conventional wisdom is I sit down every morning and I write for 4 hours, or I write 2,000 words.
Right.
But that's not how you work.
Well, I think I'm more of a binge writer. When I wrote the Alcatraz novel, I actually moved up to San Francisco for 6 months to work on that, and I found that I would go 2 or 3 days in a row of, you know, 12 and 14-hour days. I would literally fall out of bed at 7 a.m., you know, stumble to the computer, and never change my clothes, never take a shower, and I would look up 72 hours later and sort of come out of the space, and then I would just sort of not do anything for 3 or 4 days. I would shop, I'd go to movies, I'd read, I'd walk the dog, and then I would go back into it. And somehow, again, it the work got done. That said, I think I would be a lot more productive, and I think I'd be a better writer if I were more disciplined and had better work habits and did write every day. I think it is, you know, it's a cliche, but it really is a muscle that I think does need to be exercised to keep toned and honed and all that kind of thing. But, you know, you do whatever works.
Yeah, yeah, it's working.
Yeah, thank you.
Don't mess with what's working. So the list, tell me how the list came to be.
The list to be actually back in my screenwriting days. It was before I started writing my Alcatraz novel, and I wanted to write a spec script. I wanted to come up with this light, frothy romantic comedy that I could sort of knock out in a couple of weeks and my agent could sell for $1 million. And I came up with this idea of a very mismatched couple, one of these couples who have broken up and gotten back together a dozen times. All of their friends are sick of hearing about it. And so they come up with this idea of, let's make a list of things that we said we would do together at some point and we never got around to doing. We'll go through these items on the list. We'll do these activities. And when we're done, we'll feel closure and it will be easier to part and go on with our lives. And I thought, oh, well, that sounds like fun. And I started playing with it. You know, I started outlining it and just sort of thinking about it. And I realized, no, you know what, I really do want this to be a novel because I'm far more interested in the, I mean, you used the word psychology. I'm more interested in the interior lives of what's going on with this couple than I am with a bunch of, you know, this, you know, wacky gal and guy and gal running around Los Angeles doing nutty things.
Mm-hmm.
And I was really interested in the darker side of romantic love and the potential, the destructive potential of romantic and sexual love and that fine line between love and hate. You know, the list does start out as sort of a lighthearted romp, but it takes a turn and it becomes darker and hurtful. And it, you know, it does get to the point where they're grappling with this idea that they would rather destroy this person that they say they love rather than let each other go.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So. It did get dark. Wonderfully dark.
Oh, thank you. Yay, thank you.
Well, I want to get into the nitty-gritty of the book itself and the specifics of your craft and how you did it. And perhaps the best introduction is for you to read to us a little bit and kind of bring us into the world, and then we can take it from there.
Okay, I'd love to. I'll read the first page or two of the novel just to sort of keep it easy.
Great.
It's Isabel and Al. Isabel is in her early 20s, and she's type A, overachieving, a bit neurotic, a bit high-strung, and she's doing a residency in cardiac surgery. Her boyfriend, Al, is about 30, and he's a guy who went to film school. Right out of film school, had the opportunity to make his first feature film, which just by surprise turned into a huge cult classic, at which point he sort of had a nervous breakdown and hasn't worked since. So there are these two very mismatched couple, these two mismatched people. The novel's told in alternating chapters and alternating points of view, an Isabel chapter followed by an Al chapter. And so I'll start just the first page or so of the novel, and this is from Isabel's point of view.
Great. And before you start, I'll just remind our listeners that you're listening to Tara Eisen, and she's going to read to us from The List.
Thank you. She dreams about hearts when he isn't there. About one heart, actually, a seemingly average and healthy human heart, cone-shaped and hollow, embraced by a colorful network of arteries and veins. A textbook heart. The typical human heart is fist-sized, she was taught. Tuck your right elbow to your side and place your right arm at a diagonal across your breastbone, and there you are, your clenched fist, roughly the size, shape, and correct placement of the muscular, double-pumping organ of Valentine and Black Velvet Torch song fame. The heart. During the average lifetime, the average heart at 72 lubdups per minute will beat 2 billion times. Just think McDonald's hamburgers sold, Al said to her once. Just picture 2 billion patties being pumped out to poison the world and will spurt on its way enough blood to fill 100 swimming pools. Picture it like that, Al said to her once. 100 swimming pools of blood circled by 100 film executives in lounge chairs reading screenplays, dipping their toes in from time to time. The heart's intricate choreography, balancing nerve impulses and muscle contractions. Just picture Martha Graham's Eurythmics, he said, danced by women in red satin. Picture them flowing around in sync. He was trying to help her study and being no help at all, just messing her up with his silly, pointless facts. He thinks visually, she knows. He has to get the image printed, framed. Everything's a movie in his mind. That organ of Valentine and Black Velvet Torch song fame is his silly picture, not her professor's, not hers. Marlene Dietrich's face while singing Falling in Love Again in a throbbing voice, that's heart, he said to her once. Look at that quivering throat, and look how the shadow under her nose shapes a butterfly. Look at the agony bleeding in her eyes. Now you want to see heart and soul. Look at Falconetti's Joan of Arc. Look at that cinematic face torn between spirit and flesh, shadow and light. Look. I don't need your pictures to appreciate the facts, the important facts, she told him. There's no metaphor here. There's no such thing as a soul. A heart is just an organ. A heart is just a heart.
Mm-hmm. That was great.
Oh, thank you.
That was Tara Eisen reading from her latest novel, The List, published by Scribner and available in bookstores now. One of the striking things about the imagery that you use and the image of the heart, and you know, there are other recurring objects that you use throughout the novel that I thought were so effective, the casts with the red crayons and the velvet dress and glasses that Isabel's mother gives to her. And they become more than the objects themselves, and they're sprinkled really artfully throughout the novel. You know, and obviously mean more to the characters, you know, than just the simple objects themselves.
Yeah.
How did you go about kind of choosing the objects that were going to be important to you, and what do you think about the objects in relation to the storyline and to your writing?
I think objects really do take on almost a, you know, sort of symbolic or totemic feeling to us in our own lives. I mean, you know, we invest certain objects and certain images with enormous emotional import and weight, I think. You know, and it could be, you know, the stupid shell you find on the beach on your first date, or it, you know, it doesn't have to be the it doesn't have to be an object that by itself is, appears all that profound. But I think I really like using, I mean, as a writer, I like using very concrete and realistic detail as a means to express character and as a means to explore the psychology of my characters. So I think to extrapolate a little bit from the idea of objects, I think that both Isabel and Al each sort of have a central metaphor or a central theme in their lives, which is their life work. I mean, Isabel is a heart surgeon or going to be a heart surgeon, and yet, you know, to me that means she can only deal with the heart from a rather clinical perspective. You know, she can't get into the emotion and the blood of and the pumping of the heart. She needs to be able to feel it's something to be analyzed and mastered and controlled. And of course, that's, you know, wildly metaphorical. But the nice thing about that is, because she is a surgeon and a doctor, I was able to do an enormous amount of research on the heart and the functioning of the heart and the physiology of the human body that would serve as Isabel's frame of reference.
Mm-hmm.
Or how she views the word, so the world. So I love taking facts and figures and concrete, realistic detail, and using it as sort of the lens through which a character views the world. So you know, similarly, if Isabel has this sort of medical, scientific, objective perspective on emotion and the heart, Al, you know, he's a filmmaker, and so for him, he sees everything quite visually and is more engaged in the immediacy of the moment and sort of the sensory perceptions of what he sees and what he feels.
Right, right.
And again, I was able to do, there's a lot about film in the book because that's his prism, that's his perspective through which he views the world.
Yeah, beautiful. You know, you also were so great at setting up so many dichotomies between the two of them. As you mentioned, you know, science versus art, you know, her surgeon background versus his artistic background, and her fear of water versus his fear of flying.
Yeah.
And air, and, you know, their dependence and independence to each other. And I think these dichotomies really provided such a great framework for you to explore the problems between them. How did those kind of come about organically, or how did you decide on the, did they emerge as you were writing them out, or did you decide on certain dichotomies before you began?
I think I went in with an idea of certain dichotomies, and then they certainly evolved, you know, as I lived with the characters for a while. I think that they're both, I said this somewhere recently, where to me, you know, the creation of characters is very much like how, I guess, Freudian analysts look at dreams, which is by saying that every character in a dream is an aspect of your own psyche.
Mm.
And for me, the creation of characters is very similar to that. I couldn't tell you who whether Isabel or Al is more like me, or who I relate to more, or who I identify with more. As different as they are, they each, I think, really have aspects of my personality and my worldview and my temperament and all that kind of thing. Maybe I'm just saying I'm a complex.
I'm sure that's true.
I think because of that, you know, you have to sort of look at those dichotomies and those dualities within yourself, because I think to create complex, interesting characters, you have to acknowledge, you know, the complexity that we do have all, that we all have within it. I mean, you know, so for example, Isabel is a woman who is so determined not to depend on anybody and not, she sees that as weakness, you know, and not to allow anybody to emotionally take care of her, and yet that is exactly what Al is able to offer her that no one else in the world ever has, and or that she's never allowed anybody else in the world to provide for her. So it's this—it's the exact thing that she needs him so desperately for, and loves him so passionately for, that she fights so desperately.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the same is true for Al, sort of in the reverse. I think what I wanted to do was they find something in the other that they've never found in anyone else, and perhaps never will find in anyone else again. But they're not at a point in their lives where they're willing to sort of accept the vulnerability that comes with acknowledging that.
Right, right. And that was so beautifully portrayed and so psychologically true, especially for relationships at that age and time in your life.
Yeah.
Really nice.
They're both really messed up also. I mean, they're both really flawed and messed up. And something I think is sort of fun is that it seems to me sometimes that half of the people who read the book think that Isabel is just this amazing young woman and, you know, ambitious and driven and achieving and has it all together. And what is she doing with this, you know, lazy loser bum? And the other half of the people, sometimes it seems like they think Al is just such a prince of a guy, you know, nurturing and loving and emotionally available and committed and passionate. And what is he doing with this, you know, neurotic, horrible, shrewish woman?
Right,
I don't know.
And the beauty is that they're both right.
Yeah.
It's both true. I want to talk about plot because, you know, plot should be the easiest thing in the world about writing. You know, it's just, I'm told over and over, it's just what happens to the characters. It's
right.
It's so simple. And sometimes it is, and sometimes often it's not.
Yeah.
But it strikes me that the idea of a list is brilliant. You know, whether it's explicit or not, or the writer sits down with a list that they're either going to share with the author, with the reader, or, you know, they're going to keep it to themselves.
Yeah.
Giving your characters a list of tasks that they need to accomplish, you know, necessarily sets them in motion.
Yeah.
And then it's a great gimmick. Yeah, it's a great gimmick.
Yeah.
I loved it.
Yeah.
Did the list itself provide sort of the structure or outline for the book for you?
It did to some degree. I'm grateful for it that I gave myself this little gift of a plot outline so explicitly in the book. What I found was, you know, they each come up with five things, and so the initial list has 10 items on it, and, you know, the challenge was they can't just go through those first 10 items, you know, boom, boom, boom. You know, each item has to create a new experience, a new emotional experience for them that, you know, is built on, so that where they wind up at the end of that first 10 items is a surprise to the reader. It's a surprise to each of them. It's not where they expected to be. And I think it was because, you know, we're about 100 pages into the novel at that point that they finished those 10 items. For me, the challenge was, okay, what next?
Mm-hmm.
And they, you know, the device continues. I mean, there's even a joke in the book about Al and his friend are joking about the book is just a device to keep the story going. It's the MacGuffin. They're conscious of how ridiculous it is as a gimmick just to keep their story going.
Right.
But then they each start choosing additional items for the list, and, you know, so the list continues for another 200 pages. Excuse me. And with each selection at that point, I had to be really careful to structure it so that it continued to build and sustained the momentum. And, you know, the next thing Isabel chooses pushes buttons for Al in order to prompt him to the thing that he next chooses,
mm-hmm.
which creates a new dynamic between them, which then organically leads to the next thing that Isabel chooses. So I was able, I sort of imposed that initial list of 10 items on them.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But from that point on, I had to let it evolve in a different way.
Right.
If that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and it almost felt like, you know, there was such an escalation of danger and the violence they were doing to one another that it felt like a musical crescendo that was just mm-hmm. building and escalating and exploding and then, you know, the quiet stillness of the end. And, you know, it almost felt like you were on this sort of inevitable track. And I was wondering, at some point, did it feel like the characters were taking you or that you were taking them? If that makes sense, I don't know. But,
Yeah, no, I'm thinking.
Yeah, yeah.
Spoiler alert, should we give away the ending? I know that I played with a couple of different endings for the book and a couple of different resolutions, and I think I came out pushing it as, well, let's see, now I'm going to contradict myself. Some days I think I pushed it as far as I should have.
Mm-hmm.
Some days I wish I had pushed it further.
Mm, interesting.
I had a couple of different, you know, I mean, how many different endings can there be to a love story? You know, I think you've got maybe three or four.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I played with all of them at some point. Before settling on where I leave them now.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, my mood changes daily on whether or not I made the right choice.
Well, I think you did.
Oh, good, thank you.
I'll put one point in your favor there. I think you did.
Thank you. That's great. Thank you.
What was the most difficult aspect of writing this for you? Maybe we just hit on it there.
I think perhaps the balance of, you know, I've got two people who are trying to hurt each other, and that's tricky because, you know, why would anybody want to read that? Why would, what's quote, in it for the reader?
Mm-hmm.
To sort of go on, you used the word danger. I mean, you know, I'm sort of taking my characters and I suppose the reader on a dangerous psychological journey, and, you know, what's the, do I run the risk? I think I was often worried about, do I run the risk of being so off-putting with these two people that anybody would stop caring, and, you know, not only about, you know, whether or not they live or die, but whether or not they stay together and, you know, what happens to them. And so I think I was always trying to balance it with what about these two people is relatable and what about these two characters can we identify with. I mean, you know, we love, sex, passion, romance, you know, the what we are willing to go through as people to have those things can be, you know, pretty painful and pretty absurd. And I think I always wanted to get back in touch with what makes these two people vulnerable,
mm-hmm.
and what makes them relatable, what makes them human.
Right.
And, you know, the idea, you know, not everybody wants to, I think, read a love story that, you know, a lot of people have said to me, oh, my God, when I read this, you know, I've been in that kind of relationship, and it's so painful. And, you know, not everybody wants to read about themselves.
Right, right.
That way. I think sometimes you just have to be in the right mood for it. So I hoped it was, you know, identifiable without being off-putting.
Yeah, I think the draw to fiction like this is that, one, you know, I suppose it's entertaining, but two, it reveals something about yourself,
mm-hmm.
and something about, you know, what's a universal human emotion, and it makes you feel better about, you know, there are people out there that can relate to you, and you make that human connection and that psychological connection. And I think that's all you can hope for as an author, right?
I that's what you dream of as
yeah.
an author. I mean, like, you know, God, if anybody can read a sentence and identify with it and feel something about it. I mean, I'm not out to teach anybody anything or illuminate, you know, mysteries of the human condition, but if I can create that kind of, that moment of identification for another human being. I mean, that, to me, that's what art's all about.
That's what it's about, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, and that's exactly what I think this did. It was really well done. Before we go, can you give us any last-minute advice, maybe some of the best writerly advice you received or what you tell your students?
Oh, boy, what do I tell my students? Well, you know, there's this sort of tangible craft-based advice kind of things. Like, I mean, for a novel, I'm a big believer in an outline.
Mm-hmm.
Then I'm a big believer in throwing away the outline. But I believe in sort of starting with that just to comfort yourself,
mm-hmm.
with the knowledge that you have that scope of a story within you. And then sort of once you know that you've gotten your arms around it, you can sort of throw that away and just actually live in the moment, in the language, with the characters without worrying about your story quite so much. So I'm a big believer in that. I think it helps to have very, very dear and supportive friends and community. I think you have to be there for each other as writers and be kind and generous and supportive and critical when that's what is being asked for, and not being critical when, you know, you just have the writer friend who's flipping out and needs reassurance that they can do it. And the writing. I mean, you know, yeah, I wish I had better work habits. Maybe I'll grow up someday and get better about it. but I, you know, it is a job and it is work. And, you know, if you want the beach house and the, you know, garret and the romantic love affairs and you want to call yourself a writer, then, you know, you got to do the job. You got to do the work.
Yeah. Unfortunately, that's so true.
Yeah.
Oh, Tara, thank you so much for talking to us.
Oh, this has been such a pleasure. I really appreciate it. Thank you for your kind words.
Oh, well, I love the book, and I wish you most success in future endeavors.
Thank you very much, Maria. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
Bye-bye.
We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, Aaron Kyle, author of The God of Animals, will be with me. Please stay tuned. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. I'll be right back.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. Be gone 24 hours, child, seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. Darling, one month built in a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
Planetary Radio is public radio's only weekly series about space exploration. I'm Matt Kaplan, and I hope you'll join me as we explore Mars, look for life in the universe, and fly through the rings of Saturn. We'll talk with the men and women, scientists and dreamers who are guiding us to a future beyond Earth. And don't forget to enter our weekly space trivia contest. That's Planetary Radio, Mondays at 5:30 p.m. right here on KUCI.
Listen to Writers on Writing, hosted by Barbara DeMarco Barrett on Thursdays at 5 p.m. on KUCI FM in Irvine. Bye-bye.
Yee-haw!
The Sharp Show, featuring irreverent debates about politics, religion, and popular culture. Unscripted, with Sharp's off-the-cuff remarks occasionally provoking anger. Monday mornings, 8 to 9 a.m.
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit KUCI.org. kuci.org or kucitalk.org.
And welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine and streaming on the web at kuci.org. And as I mentioned earlier, this show will join the other interviews up on the web and available to you via podcast. Feel free to visit iTunes or penonfire.com for more details on that. I'm your host, Marie Stone, in for Barbara DeMarco Barrett, who will be back with you next week. And I'm joined now by Aaron Kyle. Aaron's fiction has appeared in the Atlantic Monthly, the Georgia Review, Story Quarterly, Best New American Voices 2005, and elsewhere. She's the recipient of the Rona Jaffe Award and a National Magazine Award in Fiction. She currently lives in Missoula, Montana, and her first novel, The God of Animals, published by Scribner, was released in March and is the primary subject of our discussion this evening. Erin, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, thanks for being here. This was such a great read. I really, you know, one of those not able to put down books.
Oh, I'm glad.
Yeah, it was great. Before we delve into the book itself, let's talk first about your path into writing. What initially inspired your interest in books and writing?
You know, I always was writing, even as a really, really little kid. I learned to read, I think, pretty young, and was always writing, even as a little kid, like kind of silly poetry. In fourth grade, I was like writing a novel about a magic puppy, which never actually really went anywhere. And then I went, I got my BA in English Lit and went straight through to a Master's in Fine Arts program in creative writing. So, which I think is when I really started to write more polished, finished stories. But I've been doing it forever.
Wow. Now, this book emerged from an award-winning short story of yours, Fouling Season, correct?
Yes.
And so talk about the kind of the evolution of the book from the short story.
Yeah, I wrote the story when I was in graduate school. And I had always just imagined that it was complete as a story. I really never had any intention of going back and expanding it into a novel. I think about 2.5 years passed, actually, between, you know, the publication of the story and me going back to expand it. The story is, the town that the story is set in is loosely based on the town that I grew up in. And after graduate school, I ended up moving back to Grand Junction, Colorado, and was working on a different novel at the time. But being back there, I just started thinking about those characters again and wondering, you know, sort of what happened the day after the story ended. And at that point, I just sat down and started to write out a few scenes, and then it happened really quickly. After that, it took me probably 18 months to finish the book.
Oh my gosh, that's amazing. Wow.
Yeah, I'd really been struggling with the other novel that I had been working on. I'd been working on it for like 2 years, and this one, once I allowed myself to write it, it really flowed pretty quickly.
Okay, wow, that's incredible. Do you does your love of writing short fiction endure, or are you now, through the process of this, more committed to the novel?
You know, I've gone back since I finished this novel to writing short stories again. I really love writing short stories, but after I finished the novel, I really needed some time to kind of divorce myself from it, I guess, before I could even think about diving back into another novel. So right now I'm working almost entirely on short fiction.
Wow. And do you, I don't know where I was going to go with that. Never mind. I do want to delve into the novel and to the, into your craft of how you formulated it. And I think probably the best way to do that is to have you read to us and bring us into the world, and then we'll take it from there.
Yeah, great. I'll just read from the very beginning.
Perfect. And I'll remind our listeners that you're listening to Writers on Writing, and I'm talking with Aaron Kyle, author of The God of Animals.
6 months before Polly Kane drowned in the canal, my sister Nona ran off and married a cowboy. My father said there was a time when he would have been able to stop her, and I wasn't sure if he meant a time in our lives when she would have listened to him, or a time in history when the Desert Valley Sheriff's posse would have been allowed to chase after her with torches and drag her back to our house by her yellow hair. My father had been a member of the Sheriff's Posse since before I was born, and he said that the group was pretty much the same as the Masons, except without the virgin sacrifices. They paid dues, rode their horses in parades, and directed traffic at the rodeo where my sister met her cowboy. Only once in a great while were they called upon for a task of real importance, like clearing a fallen tree from a hunting trail or pulling a dead girl out of the canal. Polly Kane disappeared on a Wednesday afternoon, and at first people were talking kidnapping. An 11-year-old girl was too young to be a runaway, so they figured someone must have snatched her. But then they found her backpack on the dirt road that ran alongside the canal, and soon they called my father. For the 2 days that the sheriff's posse dragged the canal, they traded in their white tuxedo shirts and black felt Stetsons for rubber waders that came up to their armpits, and they walked shoulder to shoulder through the brown water. I passed them on my way home from school. It was only April, but already the mayflies were starting to hatch off the water, and I watched my father swat them away from his face. I waved and called to him from the side of the canal, but he clenched his jaw and didn't look at me. "We found that girl today," he said when he came home the next afternoon. I was making Kool-Aid in a plastic pitcher, and he stuck his finger in and then licked it, tangled in one of the grates. "Is she dead?" I asked, and he stared at me. "You stay away from that canal when you're walking home, Alice," he said. "Will there be a funeral?" I pictured myself like a woman in the movies, standing beside the grave in a black dress and thick sunglasses, too sad to cry. "What do you care?" "We were partners in shop class. We were making a lantern." The truth was that Polly had been making the lantern while I watched. She had been a good sport about the whole thing and let me hold it when our teacher, Mr. McCleskey, walked by so that he would think I was doing some of the work. "I don't have time to take you to a funeral, Alice," my father said, and he put his hand on the top of my head. "There's just too much work around here. I've already lost 2 days." I nodded and stirred the Kool-Aid with a wooden spoon. There was always too much work. My father owned a stable. Between posse meetings, he gave riding lessons and bred and raised horses, which he sold to people who fed them apple slices by hand and called them baby. In the mornings, my father and I fed the horses while it was still dark, and I would walk to school shaking hay from my hair and clothing, scratching at the pieces that had fallen down the front of my shirt. In the afternoons, we cleaned the stalls and groomed and exercised the horses. It was foaling season, and my father didn't like to leave the barn even for a minute in case one of our mares went into labor. It was just as well. I didn't have a black dress.
Mm. That was Erin Kyle reading from her book, The God of Animals, published by Scribner. That reading brought up so many questions for me. I'm trying to figure out where to begin. But, you know, one of the things that was remarkable about this novel was that it was so rich with imagery and symbolism. Water, of course, which is both where Polly died, obviously, and the lack of water being in the desert, and so many other gorgeous symbols. The lantern makes an appearance throughout. Allison's clothing, which leads me into another discussion. But did you use these symbols, or did you have ideas in your mind of where these symbols would be placed, or did they kind of emerge organically as kind of on their own as symbols?
I think they emerged organically initially, you know, and then as I sort of progressed with the process of writing the novel, you know, then I could sort of look back at what was already on the page and think, okay, this is, you know, these are the tools I have to work with, like, you know, you things kind of pop in there and you don't know why, and then, you know, later on you think, wow, this is actually really important to the story. And I would find myself sort of having to go back and rearrange things or bring things forward that I had just sort of slipped in there unintentionally.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. One of the other strengths that I thought was so wonderful is that you don't overly explain your characters. Polly, you know, we're never quite sure what happened to Polly. And the mother, Marion, for example, is so compelling because she's never really fully understood. You know, we don't get the summaristic paragraph at the end that answers all of our questions. And I love that. You know, that's just kind of how life works. But I was wondering if there was a temptation for you to provide more explanations for things, or did you have a strong sense that you'd told just enough?
You know, especially as I was getting, you know, closer to finishing a draft, I did kind of look through and wonder, especially with the characters you mentioned, with Polly and with Mary and the mother, if there needed to be answers. But, you know, I think as a writer, I'm just more interested in unanswered questions. You know, in life, we so rarely get to know what happened to make people, you know, do what they do or choose the choices that they do. And to me, that's, you know, the unanswered questions are much more interesting than things with clear answers. Mm-hmm. And I was more interested in how Alice, the narrator, pieced her life together without answers, you know, the effect that it would have on her as a person.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I think it keeps the novel so much more alive in the reader's mind after they're done when, you know, when everything's tied up and neat, it's easy to walk away. And when it's not, you know, I think the reader themselves gets kind of mired in the unanswered questions. And I think it's so, so effective. There's such a temptation to, you know, to over-explain, I think.
Of course. Yeah. It's one of the things, though, about sort of the, you know, I guess the, you know, quote-unquote coming-of-age experience that, you know, these things happen to us that, you know, aren't necessarily, you can't look back and clearly explain what happened, but they all came together to kind of push a person through one phase of his or her life into the next. And I think that's definitely, you know, this story is sort of a year in Alice's life. And I think probably, you know, even if Alice as an adult looked back at that time, she wouldn't be able to explain it clearly, but, you know, everything kind of came together to move her from, you know, childhood into whatever comes next.
Right, right. And I love the device that you used of her clothing to do that. You know, she's, throughout most of the novel, she's growing out of her clothing. It doesn't fit. It's kind of painful to her. She can't yet fit into her older sister's clothing. So she's kind of this mismatched, caught between, nothing's right. And then she's taken in by Patty Jo and you know, with the expensive clothes. And it was such a clever way to show character change through clothing. I hadn't seen that before. Really effectively done.
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, that came again sort of organically. You know, I mean, initially I was sort of using it just to show that her father, you know, wasn't paying a lot of attention to her. But then, you know, it became much more important, especially as Patty Jo came in, you know, into the mix and began to sort of take care of Alice in a way that no one else was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, really, really effectively done. There's such a strong sense of place in this novel. You know, I really felt it. I've never really been on a horse ranch, thank God. but you were so effective at portraying the heat and the dirt and the smells. And I've read that you have never really spent, or you didn't grow up on a horse ranch. And how tricky is it to create that kind of sense of place when it's a foreign place even to you?
I didn't grow up on a horse ranch. I did take riding lessons for about 3 years when I was a kid. So, I had that to start from. I was very intense into horseback riding for the middle school years, you know, 11 through 13. And spent a lot of time at this barn. The barn that I spent time at, of course, isn't this barn. It was a much more functional place. But I think that's where I started from, and then the place kind of grew as the characters grew. I knew some people who had horses. I did some, you know, some research online, but the barn itself really became its own character, the way that, you know, the people did. And I mean, setting is an interesting thing because it's very much like character. You can write about someone who doesn't resemble anyone in your own life, and the more time you spend working with that character, they become real anyway. And I think setting is a lot like that too. The more time you spend with it, it just becomes realer and realer and more real. realer. You know, so it just grew out of, you know, kind of a seed of truth into what it became in the novel.
Yeah, yeah, it was really great. It was really great. The other thing that I loved that you did was exploring human nature through the use of these animals, through the horses. And so much of what was going on with the human characters in the book was reflected through the animals, which I thought was so cleverly done. You know, the inability to tame the wild darling horse. And to me, the most stunning section of the novel was the incredible description of the broodmare's suffering when they took their fowls away after they were born. You know, there was always this observation that it's just nature. You know, the kindest thing is to just let them suffer. And, you know, that kind of emerged as the theme of the novel. How tricky is it to explore human nature through animal nature? You know, I've never quite seen that done before, and it was really, really artfully done.
Thank you. I was really cautious about, I mean, really hesitant about the horses. You know, I mean, it's a little dangerous to sit down to write a book about a 12-year-old girl and a bunch of horses. You know, people have an idea of how that's going to go, and I didn't want it to be, for lack of a better word, a sort of sentimental story about, you know, girls and horses. I wanted the thing that I really, you know, was interested in my characters was that they're people who really don't have the luxury of being sentimental about animals. You know, in my upbringing, I'm a very sentimental person about animals. And these people really couldn't do that in order to keep the kind of business going that they are. And, you know, sort of the hierarchy of all of these different, you know, all this control, you know, the people are trying to control the horses, the weather is controlling everything. I guess I just sort of was interested in the way that nobody really has control over anything.
That's gorgeous. How do you begin a piece of work? Is there, and how did this short story begin? Is there an image or a character or a storyline that you want to expose? How does it begin for you usually when you sit down to write a short story or a novel?
It depends. There's always something. It's usually a character that pops into my head. In the case of this, like in the case of the original short story, which is the first chapter exactly as it stands, the first line came to me, and it was kind of random. I'm not sure why exactly, but I was in graduate school, and that line came to me, and the story built from there. You know, as far as expanding it into a novel, I think that it was definitely my interest in the characters. You know, characters that were pretty minor in the short story, like Mrs. Altman, Sheila's mother. She's the first character that made me think about going back. I was thinking more about what her life was like. She's pretty flat in the original story. She doesn't get much stage time.
Mm-hmm.
And Alice sees her as kind of a type, you know, just a rich woman who drives her rich daughter out to the barn. And I was thinking about that character and thinking, surely her life is more complicated than Alice sees it. And that was one of the things that brought me back to that story.
Yeah. Beautiful. Unfortunately, we're just running out of time. The second half hour always goes so fast for me. I look up and wonder what happened. Do you have any advice or kind of wisdom for our listeners out there who are, most of whom are probably writers themselves?
You know, I think that, you know, everybody's experience of how, you know, how things work out with anything like this, you know, anything as unpredictable as, you know, pursuing a life in, I suppose, any kind of art. And I certainly, there were really a lot of dry times, you know, times when I was having a hard time paying my rent and times when I was applying for fellowships and wasn't getting any of them. And I just think that even if in the slow times, in the dead times, you wake up in the morning and that's what you want to do, then probably that's what you should be doing.
I like that. I can use that right now. That's great. Oh, Erin, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us this evening.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Such
a pleasure.
Yeah, pleasure for me too. That was Erin Kyle, author of The God of Animals, available in bookstores now and published by Scribner. That's unfortunately all the time we have for this evening. Before I go, I'll leave you with a quote from the great Dorothy Parker. I hate writing. I love having written. I don't hate everything. I hate writing. I love having written. The writer's way is rough. Hold on. I lost my quote. Good grief. She has nothing else to say. No, that can't be true. I'm going to start over, and we're going to give Dorothy Parker her justice. I hate writing. I love having written. The writer's way is rough and lonely, and who would choose it? Well, there are other vacancies in more gracious professions, such as, say, cleaning ferry boats. Barbara DeMarco Barrett will be back with you next week. So until next time, thank you so much for joining me this evening. Good night.